For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so God does ask questions like I just mentioned. But that kind of raises a question, and that is, why? What does an all-knowing God need to know? I mean, doesn't that seem contradictory? To pose a question almost seems to contradict who God essentially is. And yet we see, like I just mentioned, dozens of places in the Old Testament, places with Jesus in the New Testament, where God directly asks a variety of people different questions. Obviously, he's not doing that to seek information. He's not trying to get that one extra bit of counsel or insight. There's a passage, I think it's in Isaiah 40, it says, "Who is the Lord's counselor?" And the obvious answer is nobody is. God doesn't need advice. And so what's he doing with these questions? Well, often if you look, it's because he's trying to get us to think about what we're doing. Look at you there. What are you doing? I mean, look at the perspective you have. I've got some questions about that perspective. In Tim Keller's book on Jesus called Encounters with Jesus, he describes how Jesus asks lots of questions, almost like a counselor. And he says, counselors know that it's not enough to simply tell people how to live. Asking questions helps the person to recognize their own errors and to discover and embrace the truth from their hearts. And that's what we're going to see with Elijah. We're basically going to see God invite Elijah into his counseling room for some time on the couch to talk, to help Elijah figure out where he's gone wrong. So that's what we're going to do. Now, this particular question is for a prophet named Elijah. That's the question. But to really appreciate, you know, just how penetrating this is, we need to do a little bit of background work. So here's some background. Elijah, who is this guy? Elijah the Tishbite. He's from a place called Tishbe, which we have no idea where it was, somewhere in Israel. He was a prophet of Yahweh. Yahweh was the God of Israel. And Elijah was a spokesman. That's what a prophet did. He was a mouthpiece for God. He would address the people on behalf of God. Elijah was a strange-looking dude. He was hairy. It says in a couple places that he would wear a leather girdle. I don't know what that looked like. I don't want to know what that looked like. But he's just kind of out there in the wilderness a lot, looking strange. Very strong-willed. He was tough. This is a man who spoke truth to powerful people, wasn't going to back down, very courageous. When he took a position, he stuck with it. This is a leader, an influential, powerful figure in Israel. Ahab, he was the king at the time. He was selfish, cruel, weak-willed, and wicked. Aside from that, he was a great guy. Now, there's one scene where him and his wife see a plot of land, but somebody else owns it. And so to get their hands on the land, they falsely accuse this person and have him publicly stoned to death so that they can take his land. Okay, and this guy would waver. Sometimes he would obey God, sometimes he wouldn't. But he had the distinction of being the wickedest king yet in a long line of wicked kings in Israel. And what made it worse was his wife Jezebel kind of encouraged him in the evil that he did. Now Jezebel herself, she was the queen of Israel. She was the daughter of a Sidonian king named Ethbaal. I'm just going to say Baal instead of Baal over and over again. Baal was a Canaanite storm god. And so she was raised to believe in Baal. And when she showed up in Israel and married Ahab, she systematically started persecuting prophets of Yahweh and replacing them with prophets of Baal. And so when you think about this whole situation, there's definitely a lot of tension in the country at this time. Here's a picture. There's Elijah right there looking hairy. And there's Ahab. Looks like he has a crick in the back or something. And then Jezebel's clearly having a bad day. Just scowling on her face. Now, we have no idea what these people really look like, but this painting does capture something. And that is when we open chapter 17 in Elijah, he is entering a hostile environment, trying to represent the interests of Yahweh and to speak for him, but basically on the run, hiding out and trying to avoid Ahab and Jezebel, who basically see him as a troublemaker. Now, one other thing we need to get into before we can really get at this question is there are three events in 1 Kings 17, 18, and 19 that lead up to God asking, "What are you doing here?" Now, without getting into too much detail on each one, for the first two events, I just want to highlight that they're kicked off by a command that God gives to go do something. That's what sets these events in motion. Then there are significant risks and challenges associated with each of these commands. It's a real test of faith in every case. And then thirdly, we're going to look at the outcome. What happened when Elijah trusted God and obeyed him? And so with this first event, it's a drought. God decreed a drought, and the command was for Elijah to go find Ahab face to face and tell him God's going to withhold rain in the land. There will not be any rain. And so this is eventually what happened. Now, the risk here, the test of faith for Elijah, is Ahab didn't want to hear there wasn't going to be rain. And he certainly didn't want to hear that Yahweh had decreed there'd be no rain. By going to Ahab and saying, "Hey, this drought is coming," Elijah was taking his life in his own hands. And then there was the additional problem of he himself. He lived in Israel and would be at the mercy, just like everyone else, of this drought. God felt like, you know, the whole country was, they were erecting altars on every hill all over Israel, not to Yahweh, but to other gods, including Baal. And God used this drought to discipline him, but it put everybody at risk. And so what's the outcome? Well, you can read about this in chapter 17. It turns out that God directed Elijah to a brook out in the wilderness where he was able to drink. He sent ravens to Elijah to feed him. And when the brook dried up, he sent Elijah to a woman who, with a kind of a never-emptying jar of flour and oil, was able to feed and sustain Elijah all through this period. So I guess the big outcome here is that Elijah stayed alive. And more than that, Elijah stuck his neck out. He obeyed God's command and saw God powerfully work. And maybe you can remember times in the past as you followed God where you were challenged to do something and you did it because you felt like it was what God wanted you to do. Maybe it was to try to help someone grow or to teach your home church Bible study or whatever. And you took that step of faith, and man, did God show up. God really, you know, delivered like he did here. And just this outcome of, you know, fruit was born and things happened. Those are some of the sweetest things that happen in the Christian life. Another event that came up was what I guess I'd call a showdown, a contest between the prophets of Baal and the prophet of Yahweh, between Elijah and these prophets of Baal. The command associated with this was that Elijah was to assemble the people of Israel and the prophets of Baal at this mountain called Mount Carmel. And again, this is difficult to do. Elijah had to get Ahab to call this meeting to order. And of course, the risks again. What if Ahab says no? What if he's like, "I don't really feel like doing that"? Or what about this? There's like 450 prophets of Baal. They outnumber Elijah big time. What if they just decide once they get there to kill him? Well, the outcome's interesting, and this time we're going to read about it. So if you got a Bible, let's read what happened. It says, Elijah came up with a plan to try to determine who the true God of Israel was. It says, bring two oxen. The prophets of Baal may choose whichever one they wish and cut it into pieces and lay it on the wood of the altar, but without setting fire to it. And Elijah says, I'll prepare the other ox and lay it on the wood in the altar, but not set fire to it. And then you guys call in the name of your God, and I'll call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by setting fire to the wood is the true God. And all the people agreed. So can you picture that in your mind? An altar to Baal, an altar to Yahweh, and the God who sends a column of fire for heaven to burn up the sacrifice is the true God. That's the test. Well, it says that the prophets of Baal called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice and no one answered, and they left about the altar which they made. And this is typical back then, to kind of whip yourself into a frenzy to try to get your God to respond. It says later here that they cut themselves to try to prove their earnestness. It says in verse 27 that it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them because Baal wasn't responding. He said, call out with a loud voice, for he's God. Either he's occupied, or he's gone aside, or he's on a journey. Or maybe Baal's taken a nap and he needs to be awakened. You know, when he says he's occupied, the translators are being gentle here. Elijah's like, maybe Baal's taken a leak. You know, maybe he went to the bathroom or he went to Kroger. And he's just mocking the fact that they've been sweating and dancing and cutting and nothing has happened. Baal hasn't responded. Well, finally, after this has gone on long enough, Elijah said to the people, come near to me. So he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around it, and he arranged the wood and cut an ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill four pitchers with water, pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And he said, answer me, O Lord, answer me that these people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you've turned their heart back again. And it says, the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust. And it licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. So, wow. Pretty powerful result. Here's a situation where a servant of God is given a command. They take a scary step of faith, and there's an amazing, amazing outcome. The problem is, if you've been following God for a while, and you've taken similar steps of faith, I mean, we've got to be honest. Sometimes the outcome isn't so amazing. Sometimes you step out and do a belly smacker. Just go off the diving board, and it's a train wreck. And we don't get the outcome that we want. And that's where this third event comes in. A major disappointment. This starts in chapter 19. If you look at the very end of chapter 18, it says, in a little while the sky grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy shower. Now why would that happen? Remember, the drought was to discipline Israel for worshiping Baal. Now that many of them have turned back to God and believed, the rain is going to come. The drought is over. And it says that Ahab rode and went to Jezreel, and the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins, and he actually outran Ahab to Jezreel. Now, this is somebody that's pretty excited. He was on foot, Elijah was, and he outran Ahab on the 20-mile trip from Mount Carmel to Jezreel, even though Ahab was in a chariot. So this is a guy kind of fueled by the excitement and anticipation of what the future has for Israel. Now that there's been this titanic demonstration of the supremacy of Yahweh. But that's when things take a turn for the worse. It says, Ahab comes back to the palace. Hey, honey, he goes to Jezebel. He told Jezebel all that Elijah has done. How he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Not the kind of thing Jezebel wanted to hear. These were her prophets of Baal. If you read the end of chapter 18, the people, along with Elijah, turned on the prophets of Baal and killed them. And so when Elijah when this news comes to Jezebel, she's pissed. These prophets were dining at her table. She had installed them and supported them herself. And now she's finding out that they're dead. And this is not the kind of woman you want to give bad news to. This is like that Cruella de Vil lady in 1001 Dalmatians, right? She's just not real, doesn't take good, bad news well. It says she sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I don't make your life like that of one of them." She's like, "Look out, my crosshairs are on you." Elijah gets wind of this, and it says he was so afraid. Let's read back here. He was afraid. He rose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. And he left his servant there, and he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. And he came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. And he said, "It's enough. Now, O Lord, take my life, for I'm not better than my father's." And he lay down and slept under a juniper tree. Okay, if you look on a map at what this guy did, this is one heck of a journey. He goes from Jezreel to Bathsheba. It's about 95 miles. And he did it because he was afraid. Now, this word has a lot of different shades of meaning. I think it was more than sheer terror. I mean, this is a guy that was facing down 450 prophets of Baal. One rendering of this Hebrew word is dismay. And that really fits with what he says further down in the passage. He says, "I'm not better than my fathers." Who's he referring to? His fathers were the long succession of prophets who, like him, were fighting to bring Israel back to worshiping Yahweh, and who, like him, failed. And he's bummed. What was the outcome he wanted? As he was sprinting ahead of Ahab on the way back from Mount Carmel, he wanted to see that whole battleship, the whole nation of Israel, turn back to God. He wanted to see Jezebel and Ahab and everybody finally concede that Yahweh was the true God. But now, that's not going to happen. That is not the outcome. It's not what he wanted. And so it says that he lay down and slept. And just went to sleep. And you know, I can relate to this guy big time. If you've really put yourself out there and you've tried to serve, tried to do something for God, and you know, despite the risks and obstacles, you were like, "Okay, I will cooperate with you." And then the outcome you thought would happen doesn't materialize. It makes you want to go to sleep. It is profoundly immobilizing. Some of us are sitting here right now, immobilized and bummed, right? The idea of getting up and trying again just isn't very appealing. He loses hope. I hope as you think about this and you just reflect on your own situation, you can see a little bit of yourself here. And one thing I want to say is disappointment in serving God is normal. Anybody that's tried to serve God for a while gets disappointed. And if I had a glass of beer in my hand, I would raise a toast to the disappointed. And I would do that because they gave a crap enough to try. They wanted to respond and be used by God to do something meaningful, and they tried, and they were disappointed. I can toast that. But right along with this, don't you get the sense there's something off here about the way Elijah's coping with Jezebel's threat? I do. Don't you get the sense that there's just something wrong with his perspective? There really is. When you get into this, you can just tell there's some things he's thinking that are really exacerbating the problem. And so that's where this question, finally, wow, 20 minutes, we finally got to the question. The question! What is the question? Well, it says that while Elijah was laying there asleep, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked and beheld there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat. Tenderness here, because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb. That's further down south on that map, to the mountain of God. And he came there to a cave and he lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said, what are you doing here? Why are you here, Elijah? Hopefully you can get a better feel for just, this is a powerful question. It was the question he needed to think about at this time. You know, you'd think, here a couple things that struck me about this. You'd think after everything that God had done for Elijah and all the demonstrations of power, when Elijah finally showed up at God's doorstep, he would have been tempted to maybe slap him around a little bit and like, get up off your feet, Elijah, the Tishbite. Get your Tish butt back to Jezreel. I had to do that. I had to try. You know, you just think, God would have been, you know, what else do I need to do? You are a prophet. Now get back on your post. But he doesn't do that. He cares for him. He expresses his care through these angels that bake some food and encourage him to take a drink and just kind of tenderly ministered to him. But he does have this question, and that's what I want to spend a lot of time on. What is it that you're doing here? In this question, I think we've got a chance to do a little reflection on our own situation. Have you seen some not so amazing results recently? Are you disappointed? Are you wondering if serving God is worth it? Are you ready to quit? Have you run away? You know, there are a lot of ways to run away. You don't have to go, you know, hundreds of miles into the wilderness. You can start to withdraw from people emotionally. You can decide not to be vulnerable. You can go to a home church meeting and you can be there, but not really be there because you're not there to engage people. You can decide to serve in manageable, kind of low-risk ways, even as you've concluded, I'll never take a risk that might expose me to that outcome I just suffered recently. You know, and if that's where you're at, this is a question that can help. What are you doing here? What are you doing in the situation that you're in? If you know, when you think about it, you realize I've backpedaled from serving God. Well, let's ask this. What are some of the reasons why Elijah ran away? You know, we can't bring him here on stage. I can't interview him and see. So what was it? But I can discern, I think you can too, as we look at this passage, some of the reasons that might have contributed to him running. One is obvious. He was disappointed with the outcome of his efforts, right? He says, I'm not better than my fathers. They couldn't turn the country around. I thought I could. I thought I would. And I didn't. And I'm disappointed. I'm so disappointed, I'm ready to die. I'm done. I've tried, and I'm not ever going to venture to do something like that again. And like I've said, I think a lot of us feel this way. Why would I go back? I had an experience, not recently, this was like in 1997. I was a new dad. We were living in a house that didn't have a lot of yard space. And so I decided I'm going to build a garden box so that I can feed vegetables to my family that I grew. And I don't know how to garden. And so I knew that I needed to get this garden box up high and elevated so it got a lot of sunlight. So I built this, you know, beautifully laid out, perfectly rectangular, 2-foot-high garden box between my garage and the neighbor's fence, filled it with like really carefully thought out soil for what I wanted to grow. Then I go to the home channel and I'm watching an episode where they're going into somebody's backyard ripping up these garden boxes. And I'm like, that's interesting. Why would you rip these up? And it turns out they have arsenic in them, because they're made out of landscaping timbers. And then I go back to my garden box And I pull the tag on the end of one of them, and I realize this stuff is laced with arsenic. I thought it was going to feed my family healthy vegetables. I'm going to gradually poison them to death, right? I worked my butt off on this garden box, and it was a colossal failure. I never grew anything in it. And I, to this day, I barely do anything related to garden because it was just, that was just such a negative experience. And you know, when you're stung, and maybe it's not just that. I mean, I was embarrassed. You know, people drive by it. What's up with that box? Let's talk about something else. Yeah, it's embarrassing when you fail. A lot of us have said we've had enough. That's exactly how we feel. So what's the problem with this kind of thinking? Well, here's, I hope you can follow me on this. Sometimes there's a difference between our desired outcomes and what God has promised, what he's actually promised to do. Take 1 Kings 17. Now, in 1 Kings 17, God told Elijah, I swear, you go do this and I'll care for you. I'll get you by a brook and I'll make sure you're fed. It'll be okay. 1 Kings 18 is a little bit different. God just says, assemble these people. Get them there. And you know, when Elijah saw what God did on that mountain and the fire came down, Elijah thought his outcome of turning the whole country around was going to come through. But you know what? God never told Elijah that the entire nation of Israel would repent. That's not what God promised. Think about some of the things that we think, the outcomes that we desire, and then the promises that God actually made. Here's a desired outcome. If I put him first and serve my spouse, I'll have a good marriage. Well, that is a desirable outcome. And you know, typically if you do that, that's what happened. But what did God really promise? As you step out and love your spouse, I'll sustain you and empower you. That's different. He hasn't promised us that all of our marriages are going to work. We desire, if I love and invest in people in my group, my home group will grow and multiply. You know, a lot of times that's exactly what happens. You come into a group where people are being loved, it grows, and two groups are formed. But the promise is different. God's promise is you'll reap if you don't grow weary. And what does reaping look like? There are a lot of benefits to living a servant lifestyle. But there's not a promise that what we set out to do, the outcome that we have chosen, will always materialize. Here's our typical approach to these things. We hear God's command. We take a step of faith and we expect an outcome that we have in mind. Maybe it's happened to us in the past. Maybe it happened to somebody else. It's that outcome that we hinge our sense of well-being on, that we hinge our hope on. What's a promise-based approach look like? We hear God's command. We take a step of faith. We expect God to honor his promises. That's different. That is really different. And then we watch him do that. And there may be other titanic, amazing outcomes that result that we're grateful for, right? But this is a different way of thinking. And if we live here, I take a step of faith on what God told me to do and my outcome will be realized, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. Because God has made promises that he's committed to keeping, and we have outcomes that we desire that he has not promised will occur. And it's important to tease those apart and keep those separate. All right, here's another thing that ran into, that caused Elijah a problem. A Messiah complex. This is when you think kind of you're the franchise player. You're the guy in the basketball court that's always got to have the ball. Give it to me. I've got to be the one that takes the situation and fixes what's wrong. This comes out very obviously when Elijah responds to God's question, why are you here? Elijah says, I've been zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Notice the focus on self that's all through here. I've been zealous. I alone. I'm the last man standing. I'm the last person representing you. It's my life they seek. He clearly felt like the whole future of the country was sitting on his shoulders. Was he really the only one left? Think about Micaiah, a contemporary of Elijah's. He was alive at the same time. He was a prophet of Yahweh. He spoke to the king as well. Or what about if you read in chapter 17, we find out that another prophet of Yahweh, a guy named Obadiah, had hid 100 prophets in caves. Elijah was not the only one, and he knew it. He knew he wasn't the only one. And worse, what does it say about Elijah's view of God when he talks like this? He's implying that this situation has spun so far out of control that God can't do anything about it. What about us? Is it possible any of us ever struggle with a Messiah complex? I'm an expert in this area, very seasoned with this. How about this? Are you frequently frustrated by the poor performance of people around you? You see somebody do something, maybe they're raking leaves, and you're like, just give me the rake. If that's the way you're going to do it, I'll just do it myself. It's incompetence. I've done that. Do you feel like you're the only one who cares? Am I the only person in this office with a work ethic? Come on. Does anybody ever pick up after themselves? Ever? Are you tired? You know, it's demanding to be the Messiah. That's a lot of weight to bear. And if you're tired, maybe it's because you're not the Messiah, right? You can't handle it. You just don't have what it takes. These are tip-offs that, you know, like it or not, we're running around feeling like we're God's gift to the church, and we've completely forgotten the way he's composed our relationships with each other in the body of Christ. In Ephesians 4, it says, the whole body being fitted and held together by that which every joint supplies according to the proper working of each individual part causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. You know, if you get this, if you get that God has put other people around so that we can work like a symphony and complement each other and get his work done, it tends to lift the weight of serving him. But if we're laboring under this sense of being a Messiah, yeah, disappointment is soon to follow. How about this? There's no such thing as a necessary man. God buries his workmen, and then he continues his work. You're going to die, and God will keep on rolling. That's like from the 1800s. That's an old school guy. How about relational isolation? Now, I got to say, Elijah had his meltdown before he was isolated. But isolation exacerbated the problems, for sure. If you read in chapter 19, it says, when he was afraid and rose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, he left his servant there. Now, this servant, his sidekick, wasn't just, you know, a butler or something. This guy went with him everywhere. He read the end of chapter 18. The servant was with him on Mount Carmel. He'd been through the dangers and the trials and the tribulations every step of the way with Elijah. They were companions. And when he needed his servant most in the pit of despair in Beersheba, when he needed sanity and some input from another human being, it says he left him and he pressed on. This isn't a major emphasis in the passage, but I felt like I just had to say something about it because truly, this is our preferred way of coping with disappointment. It's to isolate ourselves. This is the first thing that we want to do. And many of us, whether we're at a group or not, whether you're here or not, you're isolated. You've shut down and you've quit letting people be a significant part of your life. And you're doing it because of this. Because you're disappointed. And I would just say, That's a scary situation, because when we isolate, we get into self-care. We might stray somewhere we don't want to go on the internet. We might drink more than we should. We might get into some other decision-making that, in the absence of wise counsel, takes a bad problem and really makes it bad. The Bible warns against this. If you read in Ecclesiastes, it says two people are better off than one. If one person falls, the other can reach out and help, but someone who falls alone is in real trouble. It's really true. The last thing Elijah needed was to get away from all of his friends. And that is the last thing you need. So just heed that. Now, one other thing about this. You look at each of these three reasons why Elijah ran away, and I think they have a common theme. Maybe if I state them positively or state them a different way, maybe you'll see the theme. Think about disappointment with the outcome of his efforts. That's basically saying, I can make life conform to my expectations, right? If I work hard enough, I can get the results I want. A Messiah complex, that's like saying I can handle life's pressures on my own, by my own resources. Relational isolation, I just would be better off striking off alone. What do all three of those things have in common? That's self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency. Now here, if you want to be depressed, here's something to think about. If you're intent on sitting under your juniper tree, think about this. You are not built to handle every curveball this fallen world sends your way. You are that's not the way you are built. You are built to have your needs met by an all-powerful God who created you and loves you. You know, and according to the Bible, one of the biggest needs you have sitting here, not just to be delivered out of a crisis, but just the biggest crisis in our life, is that we walk around with the burden of our sin. The weight of all these things that we have done wrong that offend God. And you know what? That's a burden you can't handle. We can't labor under that. We need forgiveness. And that's not something we earn. It's given to us. Look what it says in 1 Peter 2. It says, Jesus personally carried our sins in his body on the cross so that we can be dead to sin and live for what's right. By his wounds, you're healed. Maybe you're somebody who's been running from God for a long time, who never felt like they'd be good enough for God, who's overwhelmed and just has set aside the idea that you could ever cope with your sins. Jesus says he can handle it. He can take that burden on himself. All you have to do is ask him to do it by recognizing you're sinful and asking him to forgive you. This is the first step. This is the right answer to why are you here? It's because I thought I could handle it, and God says, no, you need me. Okay, so what's the way forward? For Elijah, it says, God, and this is really weird how God does this. They're on Mount Horeb. This is the same mountain where God gave Moses the Ten Commandments. It says, the Lord told Elijah, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord wasn't in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord wasn't in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord wasn't in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? So there it is again. You know, Elijah doesn't get it yet. And so God gives him this visual display. And he's like, I'm not in the wind. I'm not in the earthquake. I'm not in the fire. You know, people have puzzled for a long time about what is God telling Elijah. And honestly, I'm not completely sure. I know this, that each of these things is a symbol of judgment in the Bible. And I think God is distancing himself from that. I think he's saying, that's not my way. That's not the normal way I operate. And he's telling Elijah instead, it's me here with you. in this gentle wind. This is the normal way, my presence with you. That's how I work. Well, Elijah is ready with a very familiar response. He says, I've been zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with a sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. He's obviously not going to backpedal from his Messiah complex. He's pretty firmly entrenched here. And so God gets a little more directive and specific about what the future holds for Elijah. He says in the next stretch, go and return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. So he's like, your time in the wilderness is over. I want you to head back to Israel. When you've arrived in Damascus along the way, anoint Hazael, king of Aram. And then Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you'll anoint king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, wherever that is, you shall anoint as prophet, in your place. Okay, so it shall come about the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu will put to death. The one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha will put to death. Yet I'll leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that haven't bowed to Baal and every mouth that hasn't kissed him. So these three guys, Hazael, Jehu, and Elisha, were used by God to destroy Baal worship in that area. Hazael undermined Ahab's reign by attacking Israel. Jehu displaced Ahab as the king of Israel and persecuted the prophets of Baal. And Elisha was instrumental in helping to wipe them out. Baalism never recovered when these guys were through with it. And just in case there's any doubt that God has things under control, he says to Elijah, FYI, I've got 7,000 people in this country who are loyal to me. This is a pretty bracing, stiff rebuke, I think. And there's a couple things we should try to take out of this. You can think about them to yourself. Let's think about them to Elijah as well. Are you overwhelmed and despondent? Remember, God cares. There's that image of his tender concern like we saw with the angels, right? But there's also this. God says, I'm not overwhelmed. I have the situation under control. Did you think my plans for the future revolved around you? They don't. I'm going to proceed without you, with you or without you. Did you think I stopped working? Is that what you really thought? Like I left the field of battle and surrendered it to somebody else? No, I didn't. I've been actively working all along. So yeah, that's some food for thought for Elijah. What about for us? Just some specifics for us. I think one thing from this whole story we can take away is if you've run from God, he's taking and has been taking initiative with you. Some of us, like I said, have been running from God our whole lives. We've decided, for whatever reason, I don't want anything to do with God. That doesn't mean God has run from you. According to the Bible, it says in Romans 5, when we're utterly helpless, Christ came at just the right time and he died for sinners. He showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while even knowing that we were in sin. His rescue plan was launched before you were ever born with full knowledge of every sin you've ever committed. You know, maybe you have sensed God tugging on your heart, a sense of him drawing to you. Or maybe God has sent people your way. We saw with Elijah, those angels, the messengers, God sent them to serve and care for Elijah. I'm not saying God has sent like an angelic being to you. But is it possible as you review the last 10 or 20 years that he has sent a steady stream of people that are trying to speak to you and draw you to him? I remember when I was first exposed to Christianity, I met a guy in a church in Pennsylvania. And when I went back home to Columbus, he wrote me every week letters trying to persuade me that Christ was who I needed. He sent me teaching tapes and books, anything he could do to engage me. You know, my response to that as a kid, I remember being irritated. I was just like, why doesn't this guy leave me alone? And I think a lot of us, that's how we feel. With somebody tries to introduce the concept of God. We're annoyed. But there's another way to look at it. Maybe it's an expression of God's love that he's continually sending people your way to try to draw you to him. I wouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth. A lot of value to what we're being exposed to. What about this? You could ask yourself, why am I here? If you're kind of, if you've checked out and run away, why not sit down with a group of friends and talk through what's happened? Go back to what you were thinking when you started backpedaling. Try to identify some of the outcomes that you expected God to deliver on. And then maybe go back and look at, well, what was it that God did promise in that situation? And can I see in concrete ways how he delivered on those promises? And maybe it was something else like that list. Like, I thought God didn't care. I thought he was disengaged. It may be, who knows? But we have to take these lies that led to our flight and dragging, kicking and screaming to the truth. Another thing you can do, and I think this is a good heart question, is ask yourself, is it possible that somewhere along the line I started valuing the outcome of my service more than God himself? You know, the treasure in 1 Kings 19 was God's presence in that gentle wind. When the disciples came back from preaching the gospel and casting out demons, remember what Jesus said? He said, don't rejoice because the spirits obey you. Rejoice because your names are registered in heaven. That's the real precious thing that we have that nobody can take away from us. And somehow, over time, you can get so hung up on succeeding that that becomes more valuable to you than your relationship with God itself. And then I would just urge you to reengage. You know, an obvious point I missed so far in the Elijah story is when God finally talked to him, what was his command to do? Get back into battle. Go back to Israel. Stay at your post. Finish your job. And I think one of the most heroic thing that some of us are going to ever do in our Christian life is to get back up off the bench, to reaffirm that God is good, to reaffirm our belief he does honor his promises, and to get back in the fight. And man, what a precious thing that is when someone does. Because folks that have been following God for a long time and they've seen their ups and downs, there's a lot of wisdom, a lot of self-reliance that's been broken. And somebody like that surrendered to God again in service has some good years of ministry ahead of them. And so I would just urge you, you know, why are you sitting there? If you know you've checked out, re-engage and trust God again. So, okay.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.